diesmal an Spezialitäten an seinem Stand zu bieten hat?
Also was wir neu haben, ist die schwarze Balkenbrille, früher auch Porno-Balkenbrille genannt.
Die ist doch nicht neu, die kenne ich. Habe ich zu Hause liegen.
Ja, schon, aber die aktuelle Version hat einen UV-Schutz eingebaut. Man kann sie also wirklich als Sonnenbrille auch tragen.
Wir laufen jetzt Padelun im Erdgeschoss hinterher. Wir stehen hier vor dem neuesten Produkt. Beschreib mal Padelun.
Hier kann man einen Lichtbildausweis bekommen. Das heißt, ein hübsches kleines ID1-Kärtchen mit Lichtbild, das wir direkt hier anfertigen können. Wir haben hier ein professionelles Fotostudio aufgebaut. Und dann kann man Daten angeben und die werden auf diesen Ausweis gedruckt. Also jeder kann sich einen schönen Namen ausdenken oder einen Künstlernamen oder auch seinen Realnamen nehmen und hat hinterher ein Kärtchen, mit dem ich mich überall, wo ein Lichtbildausweis gefordert ist, mich ausweisen kann.
Ist aber nicht wirklich legal, oder?
Natürlich, völlig legal. Jeder kann einen Lichtbildausweis auch sich selber machen, wenn er möchte oder sie möchte. Und insofern ist das völlig legal. Es ist natürlich kein amtlicher Personalausweis. Es ist ein Lichtbildausweis.
Aber wird ja auch nicht immer verlangt, sondern steht oft Lichtbildausweis da.
Ganz genau. Und für die meisten Teile, also in eine Disco komme ich damit sicherlich schon rein, auch wenn ich unter 21 bin.
Und seid ihr auch so equipped, dass ihr ein RFID-Schreibegerät da habt, um es auf die Chips zu speichern?
Das Besondere an diesem ist, der ist besonders sicher, der hat keine Chips drin. Und deswegen die Version 1, die wir hier auf diesem Kongress haben, ist komplett ohne Chip. Unsichere Ausweise haben wir überlegt, werden wir dann nächstes Jahr anbieten.
Großartig. Also alle, die Lust haben, sich endlich mal einen Lichtbildausweis machen zu lassen, hier im Erdgeschoss im BCC. Wir sind jetzt hier vorbeigelaufen, eben am Föbut und ein Padeluns neuem tollen Lichtbildausweisprodukt. Jetzt kommen wir vorbei am AK-Vorrat. Wir erinnern uns, es gab mehrere Großdemonstrationen von euch. Was macht ihr denn zurzeit?
Wir versuchen uns zu wehren gegen den ganzen Populismus, der in den Medien hochgekocht wird, weil ja nun auch gerade in Deutschland das Thema wieder sehr warm, sehr heiß ist. Und wir fürchten, dass im kommenden Jahr die hier auf bundesdeutscher Ebene wieder neue Gesetzgebungen durchdrücken wollen, um das wieder einzuführen.
Was deutet darauf hin, dass ihr diese Befürchtung habt?
Naja, dass die CDU und CSU sowas ganz toll findet, ist ja klar. Und hinzu kommt, dass jetzt Anfang Dezember die SPD auf ihrem Bundesparteitag blöderweise, wenn auch knapp, auch für einen Antrag gestimmt hat, der die Vorratsdatenspeicherung, wenn auch in leicht abgeschwächter Form, will. Und wir sind da der Meinung, grundsätzlich geht das nicht, weil das die Unschuldsvermutung umkehrt, weil das Zwietracht, weil das jede Menge Probleme in die Gesellschaft reinbringt, die wir in dieser Form noch nicht hatten. Das ist also auch aus rechtspolitischer Sicht ein völliger Tabubruch, der mit so einer neuen Vorratsdatenspeicherung wieder eingeführt worden. Und wir wollen es mit Händen und Füßen wehren, so gut wir das halt können.
Und was genau habt ihr mit dem CCC zu tun? Also wir sind hier im BCC, warum AK-Vorrat und CCC?
Naja, es gibt Leute aus dem CCC, die den AK-Vorrat mitgegründet haben. Es gibt immer Schnittmengen, genauso wie mit dem Fürbot oder auch mit einzelnen Parteien. Sind Leute bei uns im AK-Vorrat drin. Wir sind ja eine offene Gruppe, jeder kann mitmachen, auch anonym. Nur über eine Mailingliste, man braucht sich sonst nicht anmelden. Kann rein, kann raus, macht mit oder auch nicht mit. Wenn keiner was macht, passiert auch nichts. Deswegen sind wir auch hier, weil wir ja viele Leute treffen, die zwar aus technischer Sicht so an der ganzen Materie dran sind, aber ohne dass ich das böse meine, viele Leute im CCC, denen fehlt schon noch eine politische Komponente. Das war immer so, es wird wahrscheinlich auch immer so bleiben. Vielleicht ist es gar nicht schlecht, wenn wir hier stehen, die Leute ankommen und die Fragen haben, denen auch zur Verfügung stehen.
Und was ist, nochmal zum Beginn Frage, was ist eure aktuelle Aktion? Gibt es eine?
Ja, sowas haben wir nicht. Wir haben jetzt Mitte Dezember einen Aktionstag gehabt. Wir machen eine kleine Demo jetzt am dritten Tag. Das machen wir jedes Jahr hier so, klein und fein, ohne großen Aufwand. Und wir versuchen, auf die sachlichen Ebenen zu argumentieren. Wir haben jede Menge Printprodukte. Wir versuchen, an die Politiker anzugehen, auch in Brüssel. Wir waren letztes Jahr öfters in Brüssel und haben versucht, den Leuten da zu erklären, was unsere Bedenken sind, auf einer sachlichen Ebene, auch anhand von Statistiken zu zeigen, dass das völliger Unsinn ist und völlig unverhältnismäßig ist, was wir da wollen. Wir wissen, dass wir die Welt nicht retten können, aber wir versuchen es wenigstens ein bisschen zu schieben.
Und wie ist der Anklang der, wie du selbst meintest, teilweise unpolitischen Hacker hier? Sind sie interessiert?
Naja, ich kann da kein allgemeingültiges Bild für abgeben. Ich meine, die kein Interesse und keinen Bock haben, die kommen wahrscheinlich auch nicht vorbei. Auf der anderen Seite sind halt einige Leute, die so erstmal so schnuppern und wo man schon ins Gespräch kommt. Und offen sind die hier. Also das kann ich dir schon bestätigen.
Noch eine Etage höher dann finden wir Drohnen. Wie wir von Russland wissen, kann damit auch unabhängig Bilder über Protestbewegungen produziert werden. Ansonsten sieht es vor allem toll aus, wenn sie durchs BCC kreisen, aus Styropor oder aus Metall. Auf dieser Etage ebenso befindet sich die Blinken Area und wir finden eine Klappermaschine. Hier können mit einer Telex SMS empfangen werden.
So klingt es. Und was genau ist es?
Also es ist eigentlich ein alter Fernschreiber, den wir jetzt hier angekoppelt haben, dass man da SMS hinschicken kann und der druckt die dann aus.
Das heißt, Fernschreiber kann man schon am Deck ankoppeln oder wie habt ihr das gemacht?
Ja, mit Hilfe eines Computers dazwischen schon.
In der Nähe dieser Telex findet man was ganz Wichtiges, einen Teil der Infrastruktur des Kongresses, Eventphone. Hier kommen Leute hin, um ihre Decktelefone anzumelden, um untereinander telefonieren zu können oder über Telefon die Vorträge mithören zu können. Mit GSM-Telefon geht es inzwischen auch, dazu muss aber eine extra SIM-Karte gekauft werden. Da hier im BCC auch eine GSM-Funkzelle herumsteht, wenn die Hacker vor Ort sind. Wie viele Decktelefone sind schon angemeldet?
Oh, ich denke, wir haben jetzt so ungefähr so 200, 250 Telefone, dürften jetzt mittlerweile drin sein. Also das sind die Decktelefone, die jeder mitbringen kann. Bei den GSM-Telefonen habe ich gerade keinen Überblick, da ja auch viele Leute ihre alte SIM-Karte von letztem Jahr mitbringen und ihr Telefon einfach wieder in Betrieb nehmen.
Wie viel schafft ihr denn? Gibt es einen Zusammenbruch?
Na, also bisher haben wir es noch nicht geschafft, es zum Zusammenbrechen zu bringen. Dafür waren es einfach noch zu wenig. Die Größenordnung, die wir so getestet haben, waren so bis 1500. Läuft es noch relativ entspannt. Im Sommer auf dem Camp, da hatten wir eine ganze Ecke mehr durch die ganzen GSM-Telefone. Das funktioniert aber auch ohne Probleme, mehr oder weniger.
Und ich stehe hier gerade schon eine Weile neben dem Tisch. Ich habe drei beobachtet, die inzwischen ziemlich verzweifelt wieder mit ihrem Telefon weggegangen sind. Das heißt, nicht jedes Telefon kann hier einfach eingeloggt werden.
Der Großteil der Telefone kann eingeloggt werden, aber es gibt immer noch ein paar Telefone, die diesen Deck-Standard nicht so vollständig sauber implementieren. Und die kann man dann leider nicht anmelden. Also wir versuchen immer unser Bestes und probieren es teilweise mehrfach. Manchmal hilft einfach Batterie raus und wieder rein und dann noch zweimal versuchen. Aber es gibt auch einfach Telefone, die partout nicht wollen.
Habt ihr es schon mal mit anderen Deck-Geräten funktioniert, wie zum Beispiel Babyfonen?
Also wir hatten schon mal so Sachen da. Es gibt so zum Umhängen so kleine Deck-Geräte, die auch so als Babyfon gedacht sind. Die hatten wir auch schon mal. Es gab mal welche, die hatten sich ein Decktelefon in einen Anzug eingebaut. Da waren dann die Tasten auf dem Jackett vorne drauf. Also da gibt es schon die lustigsten Sachen. Und wir hatten auch mal jemand, der sich so ein Decktelefon in ein ganz altes Wählscheibentelefon eingebaut hat und der das dann auch mit durch die Gegend tragen konnte. Also hier kommen schon die seltsamsten Geräte an, unter anderem auch selbstgebaute.
Und jetzt mal so rein, so technisch, funktioniert ihr wie eine große Telefonanlage zu Hause?
Ja, so in etwa, also so wie viele Telefonanlagen zu Hause wahrscheinlich, wenn man mehrere zusammennimmt. Vom Prinzip haben wir eine Anlage, wo jede Menge Deckantennen angeschlossen sind. Diese Deckantennen sind so wie Access Points im gesamten Gebäude verteilt und werden zentral halt von einer Telefonanlage beackert. Und da melden wir die Telefone an und dann kann man halt auch im gesamten Haus durch die Gegend laufen, ist dann erreichbar darüber.
Wer mehr von oder über den CCC im BCC erfahren will, höre Radio in deinem Lokalradio oder per Stream.
Behind enemy lines.
Der 28. Chaos Communication Kongress vom 27. bis zum 30. Dezember 2011 im Berliner Kongresszentrum.
In Berlin findet derzeit der 28C3, das ist der 28. Chaos Communication Kongress statt. Das ist eine jährliche Veranstaltung vom Chaos Computer Club. Jetzt in Berlin ist Oleander Reis. Guten Morgen.
Guten Morgen. Du musstest ja mal wieder mich als Opfer.
Ich musste dich, wie immer, wenn ich jemand hier in irgendeiner Sendung wegen Techniksachen anruft, dann ist es immer der Oleander Reis.
Warum?
Weil das so ist.
Okay.
Ja, das hat geheime Gründe.
Ich bin mit anderen Menschen.
Oleander, du klingst so herrlich wach, ne?
Ja.
Das liegt wahrscheinlich daran, dass du unsere Frühschicht in Berlin nicht empfangen kannst.
Ja, daran und zum anderen, dass ich heute Nacht im NOC-Helpdesk gesessen habe.
Wo hast du gesessen?
Am NOC-Helpdesk.
Was ist das?
Das ist der Helpdesk. Also wenn du ein Problem hast, gehst du dorthin vom Network Operation Center. Das heißt, die das Netzwerk dort treiben.
Das heißt, du konntest wieder nicht deren Infrastruktur einfach mal so lassen, wie sie ist.
Nein, doch. Da hatte ich überhaupt keinen Einfluss drauf. Ich war eigentlich nur dazu da, um zu bestätigen, ja, es geht nicht, mal ein Kabel zu holen oder zu sagen, probier das und das mal.
Alles klar.
Das war mitten in der Nacht zum Glück nicht vorgekommen, ist, dass irgendjemand was zum Meckern hatte, außer einer.
Ole, du bist jetzt auf dem 28C3. Habe ich denn eben soweit gut beschrieben als jährliche Großveranstaltung des Chaos Computer Clubs?
Ja, sollte man vielleicht mal sagen, was das überhaupt ist.
Also, ja, erklär das doch mal bitte.
Da treffen sich Sympathisanten und Mitglieder des TCCs, also des Chaos Computer Clubs. Der ist jetzt, wie gesagt, der 28. Das heißt, den gibt es seit 28 Jahren. Und findet seitdem her, soweit ich weiß, jährlich statt und ist auch bisher nicht ausgefallen. Ja, und das, was heißt das Besondere? Die Sache dabei ist halt, dass sich da ganz viele Leute treffen, die eben entweder mit dem CCC sympathisieren oder dort selber Mitglied sind und halt entweder sich ja hauptsächlich um Bits und Bytes herumbewegen, aber auch politische Inhalte und was weiß ich. Alles, was sich halt um diese Welt der großen bösen Wolke und alles drumherum bewegt.
Das böse Internet.
Zum Beispiel.
Ja. Ole, gibt es dieses Jahr irgendeine Besonderheit oder sind jeder Chaos Communication Kongress in irgendeiner Hinsicht gleich? Oder ist da irgendwas?
Ja, es gibt eine ganz große Besonderheit und der Anteil der neuen Leute, also die zum ersten Mal auf der Veranstaltung waren, ist immens groß. Der hat sich über die letzten Jahre schon sehr viel gesteigert, was halt auch zeigt, dass sich diese Szene halt eben vergrößert hat und in ganz verschiedenen Schichten der Gesellschaft, wenn ich mal so ausdrücken möchte oder darf, wieder oder sich wiederfindet dort. Und da merkt man schon, dass es halt nicht mehr so ein Nischenpublikum ist. Also es sind irgendwie, ich weiß nicht, also auf der Keynote, das heißt auf dem ersten Talk im Saal 1, es gibt drei Säle, wo dann verschiedene Talks abgehalten werden, wo irgendwelche Leute was erzählen, mehr oder weniger interessant. Und da wurde zum Beispiel am Anfang gefragt, wie viele Leute sind neu, und da hat man dann eindeutig gesehen, dass da, na sagen wir mal, gut ein Drittel neu war. Also zumindest von den Leuten da im Raum. Und das war schon eine relativ beeindruckende Zahl. Ansonsten ist es eigentlich wie immer, es ist wie immer rappelvoll und ja.
Lohnt es denn?
Was heißt wie immer, was?
Lohnt es denn?
Es lohnt dann, wenn man dort sich mit identifizieren kann, wenn man es mal so ausdrücken kann.
Was gibt's heute so als Tagesordnung? Oder ist die überhaupt nicht festgelegt?
Alles Mögliche. Also es ist, dann sollte man sich am besten den Fahrplan anschauen. Das ist das Pentabar-System, da kann jeder gucken, was so passiert. Und dort sieht man dann die Räume und es gibt auch noch Workshops neben diesen besagten Vorträgen. Und allgemein treffen sich halt irgendwie die Leute, sitzen irgendwie an einem Tisch und schauen sich mal in die Augen, während sie irgendwas coden.
Alles klar. Gibt es noch irgendwas, über was wir noch reden müssen?
Eigentlich nicht.
Ich
soweit sagen.
Alles klar. Danke, Oleander.
Das Besondere ist halt irgendwie, dass auch das Medienecho inzwischen ziemlich groß ist. Also du siehst die ganze Zeit irgendwie.
Ja, eben die wichtigste Morningshow überhaupt ruft dich gerade an und berichtet drüber. Ja.
Nein.
Das ist natürlich so.
Ja.
Okay, danke, Oleander, und viel Spaß noch in Berlin.
Ja. Gut. Euch ebenfalls noch Tschüss und den lieben Hörern.
Die lieben Hörerinnen und Hörer an den Rundfunkempfangsgeräten hier in Marburg und Umgebung. Ja. Tschüss, Ole!
Tschüss.
Ja, en tot slot heb ik dan een stukje wat ik heb opgenomen van de Amerikaanse radio. Gaat over vleesetende paarden. En is een interview met Q Cullen. Q Cullen is een mede longrider die de hele wereld overtrekt op zoek naar genenmateriaal van uitgestorven paardenrassen. Dit kan schokkend zijn.
Humans have known that horses can consume protein different types. I mean, when the book was released, there were originally 18 different types of meat, including human, that we knew horses had eaten. And this had occurred in 30 countries over a space of 4,000 years.
gentlemen, we know of America.
This English horse got loose and then systematically went through the streets of Lucknow, killing people and tearing them apart. And if you sit down with him, you say, okay, look, I'll just put it on the table and you decide. And I think that's what I'm talking about. You know, you're such a great example of this, Tim. I mean, you look at the book, you go, well, I don't know. You know, I see a lot of kooky stuff in my life, and I don't know. And at the end of the book, you go, you know what? I think the guy's kind of right.
If I put the miles in, will you invite me into the Long Riders?
Maybe. Chicago is a long time coming, and you change getting there, I'll tell you.
What is going on, my friends? This is Tim Benall of BenallOfAmerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 6. Big, big thanks to our good buddy Pete Diggins for providing the theme music to this installment of the program. Check out his website, www.aurophonic.com, and you spell that AuroPhonic.com. Check it out. As noted at the end of last week's episode, tonight's program kicks off the final four of Season 6. Truly the home stretch for the season, and I can't think of a better guest for the home stretch than equestrian researcher and accomplished long rider, Colin O'Reilly, for a discussion on his groundbreaking book, Deadly Equines, The Shocking True Story of Meat-Eating and Murderous Horses. I'll pause there and let you digest that, no pun intended, The Shocking True Story of Meat-Eating and Murderous Horses. Over the course of this two-hour adventure, we're going to discuss Cullen's powerful case for meat-eating horses, including historical accounts from ancient and contemporary times, the collective equestrian amnesia that has befallen our culture, and the reaction to his research from the equestrian community, the scientific community, and people who work with horses every day. But really, that's just the meat-eating horses part of the conversation, because we're also going to discuss murderous horses, a completely separate but equally bizarre anomaly that Cullen has uncovered. He's going to have a ton of stories about murderous horses and speculation on what makes them so savage. And as if all that is not enough, we're also going to talk about Cullen's accomplished career as a long rider and his organization, the Long Riders Guild. Chances are, if you're like me before I met Cullen, you don't have any idea what a long rider is. After you're done listening to this episode, you're going to have an extensive knowledge of the world of long riding. And trust me, my friends, it is amazing. We're going to learn all about the practice, the world of long riding. I don't even know if you'd call it a sport. I'm not quite sure what you'd call it. It's almost like a vision quest. And Colin O'Reilly really is a major player in the world of long riding. So you're going to learn all about that stuff. Really a surprising sort of twist for me as I got into the conversation with Cullen, because I found the long riding stuff equally interesting to the meat eating and murderous horses. So it's almost like a threefer episode here. Lots of stuff going on, lots of discussion on a whole bunch of different equestrian related stuff. It is, pun intended, a barn burner of a program. This one is definitely going to end up in the rotation for BOA Audio Classic episodes. You are about to enjoy a true gem. Fascinating, enlightening, and awe-inspiring, this conversation is a proverbial long ride of esoteric insights on not only equines but also humans with the truly remarkable Colin O'Reilly. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Colin O'Reilly, allow me to provide you with a little background on him. Colin O'Reilly has spent more than 30 years studying equestrian travel techniques on every continent. After having made lengthy trips by horseback across Pakistan, he was made a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society and the Explorers Club. Upon completing his book, Khyber Nights, he founded the Long Riders Guild, the world's first international association of equestrian explorers. The organization has members in 40 countries, all of whom have made a qualifying equestrian journey of at least 1,000 miles. The Guild has supported more than 100 equestrian expeditions on every continent except Antarctica. Cacolin is married to the Swiss long rider Basha Cornwall-Leh, who rode her Cossack stallion Count Pompey from Volgograd to London, becoming the only person in the 20th century to ride out of Russia. The O'Reillys are the webmasters of the Long Riders Guild website. At 2,000-plus pages and still growing, and having now been visited by more than 1 million people worldwide, this website is the repository of the largest collection of equestrian travel information in human history. Additional material from the O'Reillys can be found at the Long Riders Guild Academic Foundation. And let me give you the URLs for both those websites. The Long Riders Guild can be found at thelongridersguild.com. Pretty simple, all one word, the Long Riders Guild. The Long Riders Guild Academic Foundation. This one's a little easier. It's just lrgaf.org. lrgaf.org. Long Riders Guild Academic Foundation. Check it out. And with all that said, let's get down to business and rock and roll. This interview was recorded on October 12th, 2011. Cacolin O'Reilly talking about deadly equines, the shocking true story of meat-eating and murderous horses. On BOA Audio, Season 6. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio, Season 6. And I am just super excited about this edition of the program. I had the fantastic opportunity to read this man's book yesterday and was completely blown away. If I wasn't reading it on the computer, I'd say that I couldn't put it down. But I couldn't pull myself away from the computer while I was reading this book. It was just that mind-blowing and amazing. And fantastically put together, too. So just a complete all-around home run effort by this guy, and I'm dying to get him on the program here to talk about his fantastic research. The book I'm talking about is Deadly Equines, The Shocking True Story of Meat-Eating and Murderous Horses. And with a title like that, I'm sure people are like, whoa, this is going to be crazy. But like I said, when I went into the book, you know, he makes the case so well for meat-eating and murderous horses that by the end of the book, you're like, you know, your worldview has changed, at least as far as equines go. So just a fantastic piece of work, and I'm just dying to dig into his brain here and find out more about this bizarre, as he calls it, O'Reilly anomaly. And kudos to him. He tagged his name there on the anomaly. I'm talking about Cacolin O'Reilly, coming to us actually direct from France, which is very exciting to have an international guest on the program once again. Cacolin, I'm thrilled to have you here on the show and can't wait to discuss deadly equines.
Thanks for talking to me about it, Tim.
I should also mention you're part of I think you're the founder of the Long Riders Guild, and let's give the website for that is thelongridersguild.com, pretty easy. And I have no real prior knowledge of horses, and this is actually a cool part about the book, too. I learned so much beyond just the deadly equines part. I just learned a tremendous amount about horses, and I'm going to assume or presume that a long rider is someone who actually, you know, and I'm going to sound like a fool here, but someone who takes a long ride on a horse, like we're talking thousands of miles, right? Is that what a long rider is?
Yeah, the Long Riders Guild is the world's first international association of equestrian explorers, and we have members in 44 countries. Every member has to have ridden a minimum of 1,000 miles to be invited.
Wow.
It's a non-competitive academic international association. We have members, and like I said, around the world, and they have done some really remarkable equestrian journeys. The Russian long rider Vladimir Fasenko rode 19,000 miles from Patagonia to the top of Alaska.
Holy shit.
Gordon Naismith, the Scottish long rider, rode from the tip of South Africa to the Olympics in Munich, and it just goes on and on.
Wow. You know, I'm sure there's places where you can hear about this stuff, but I've never really heard, I didn't know this was still going on nowadays. You know, people, you think that it was obviously going on back in the day. People didn't have planes and cars, so they traveled quite a distance by horse, but people are still doing that. That's amazing.
Well, it's interesting because the Long Riders Guild started in 2000. Equestrian travel had reached such a perilous point where it was almost about to go extinct. And I had just finished a giant book about my own travels in Afghanistan and Pakistan called Khyber Nights. And I realized that, you know, we were about to lose it. And so I called the first international meeting, and there were originally five of us from three countries. And now, 11 years later, it's spread to 44 countries. It's the only equestrian association of its kind in the world. And it's open to any human who wants to get on a horse and take a life-changing equestrian journey. And we've now mentored more than 100 equestrian expeditions on every continent except Antarctica.
Wow. I don't know if I could do long riding.
Well, the thing about this is, and I think this is important for people to understand, because long riders aren't your traditional horse people. You know, if you, and I know I'm speaking primarily to an American audience, so let me put this in American context. At the beginning of the First World War, there were approximately 22 million horses in America. And by 1930, the vast majority of those horses were all dead. The cavalry was dying, or had just about gone extinct. Mechanization had taken over agriculture. People had stopped traveling because of the cheap Ford automobiles. And by the end of the Second World War, horses were pretty much, they were just pushed right to the sideline. And in the resulting vacuum that started, say, from 1955 until the year 2000, we've had a shift in how we view horses and what horses are used for. And you have a lot of prestige transport. You have a lot of social hierarchy, and horses are a reflection of who you want to be seen as socially. And long riders and equestrian travelers aren't like that. It's about Tim going out and finding a reliable, affordable, good horse, and he puts a saddle on that animal, and these two species then set off on a journey of inner and outer exploration. It's got nothing to do with somebody giving you a blue ribbon, because you give it to yourself.
Fantastic. Yeah, well, now you're selling me on this. Maybe I could do it. I don't know, though. I'm a bit like, you know, I live in the suburbs here. I'd be like checking my email on my phone all the time.
Well, I'll give you a good example. of this and how this affects people. One of the original founding members is a guy from Maine named DC Vision. And this guy had never been near a horse, not on one, never stood next to one.
Wow.
And he set off on a journey across the United States with a Shire mare from a Maine logging camp, and he rode 14,000 miles nonstop to the United States. And so what you're talking about is not about taking horses and making them jump over painted sticks or making them stick their legs out in some sort of ornate gymnastic ballet movement. You're talking about you and your horse exploring part of the world. And there are things that you do and don't do, but these are things that everybody can do, and that's the difference.
Yeah, you raise an interesting sort of point there, too, that I hadn't really considered even having read the book, but you crystallized it so well, too, that it's really strange that back in the day, and we're talking like 100 years ago, 150 years ago, whatever, you know, almost everybody probably had a horse, or the vast majority, you know, the majority of people probably had horses. And now it's
only
these rich fat cats are the ones who can afford the horses. And normal people that have horses, you know, probably have to work like a second job to maintain the horse. It's like this law of supply and demand actually has really been reversed.
You're right about this, and there's a really interesting dimension to this, and it ties into deadly equines. And that is that, for the sake of argument, let's say we're talking about our great-grandfathers. You know, those people had access to the daily information about horses that most people today don't have a clue about.
Right.
I mean, in the book I explain this in the horse travel handbook I'm writing about. You know, when I try to tell people how you go about buying a horse, if I tell someone, can you go out and buy me a car? I mean, you can tell your little 18-year-old sister, go buy me a car, and she's going to go out and go, okay, let's see, the door closes, the odometer works, the gas tank doesn't leak, it starts, okay, the tires aren't flat, she'll bring you a car back. If you go say, go buy me a horse, she can't do it. And people used to have that sort of knowledge. Tim.
Yeah.
They could make journeys. They knew how to feed horses. They knew what horses were like. And part of what the Deadly Equine Project demonstrates is that there was a lot of information previously known to the equestrian world that's now been lost.
Indeed. Yeah. You're bringing this out, you know, into the public eye again, which is fantastic. Like I said, it changed my whole view of horses. Now, before we've already gone off on quite our side road here. Let's do the bio background. You know, who is Cucullin O'Reilly, and, you know, how did you get interested in horses, and take us sort of on your journey, and then how you discovered essentially the O'Reilly anomaly.
Well, I have a twin background in investigative journalism and in equestrian exploration. And I graduated from Inter-American University and took my journalism degree there. I briefly worked for the Seattle Times as a city reporter, and then I was hired to start a very controversial journalism program, which was headquartered in Peshawar, Pakistan, and I formulated the first journalism program for the Afghan Mujahideen. I got all the different resistance leaders together, and I got the best people they had, and I trained them to be journalists, and we put them into the country, and we were the first people to report on the jihad against the Soviets at that time. And when all that was finally finished, then I resumed my career as an equestrian explorer, and I made journeys in Pakistan, and that resulted in my book called Khyber Nights. And then at the same time, you know, I was really reaching a crossroads here personally, and I had decided that, you know, equestrian exploration meant more to me than writing about what was happening in Seattle or, you know, any other big city. Mm-hmm. And I felt that there was a real need to preserve mankind's information about horses. And as I explain in the book, you know, the whole concept of equestrian history right now is just, it's almost gone. And those books that are available are basically just parroting what's been said before. And so there is, I don't see very much evidence of any new sort of research. And I think that's really a sad thing and a bad commentary on the situation.
Yeah, absolutely. You point that out in the book, too, that, you know, there's all these, you can take all kinds of crazy courses in colleges nowadays, but it seems like there's a very limited amount that's around horses and horse history. And as you point out, horse archaeology, which is, you know, would you think that would be like second only to humans. You see all kinds of crazy stuff going on with horses throughout human history. So,
well, you know, it's interesting that let's take the year 1900. And in 1900, what they described as the urban herd that lived inside London was so vast you just couldn't believe it. I mean, there were so many hundreds of thousands of horses that lived in London, and they did everything. They pulled the trams, they delivered the goods, you know, they took people to work, they delivered the doctor to the patients. Horses were there, and they didn't just live in, you know, the little stable behind the house. They lived in sheds, they lived in alleys. There was one four-story horse stable there, and they jump over to New York. There was a stable in New York that was one city block.
Wow.
That's how big it was. We're talking maybe 1,000 horses.
Holy
and
Moses.
The impact of these animals on human development had reached a pinnacle. And yet, when you look at what they were doing and the influence that they had on us as a species, and that wasn't very, very long ago. And now, where is it? And who's talking about it? You know, it's just been pushed right to the edge, and we just almost don't even discuss it.
Yeah. I'm stunned to hear, you know, more about this. You just how prevalent these horses were. It's amazing. It's like a shared society that we've cast them out from modern society. It's just bizarre looking at the history.
When you think about American culture, you know, we think about, well, I'll give you two names, John Wayne and John Ford. You know, think about the great cavalry movies with John Wayne in them. You know, and so he pulls his saber and he goes charge, and there he goes riding across Monument Valley. Meanwhile, back in New York, you probably had 500,000 horses living in that city. And the things that happened there with horses on a daily basis were just, you know, you have to understand horses were as prevalent as cars, and people knew as much about them as cars. You know, I'll give you another example of history that may probably startle you. In 1872, there was a giant equine epidemic called the epizootic.
Yeah,
and it started at a farm in Canada.
Yeah,
yeah. And it raced in September, and it raced straight down to Cuba, went all as far as Panama. It raced all the way over to California, and it just decimated the entire equine population of North and Central America. And who remembers that today and talks about it?
Well, yeah, and you point out in the book that it to go beyond that, it decimated the population of horses, and then all the, you know, it's like what people say what would happen if the power went out nowadays. It's like all the cities ground to a halt because there's such a shortage of horses, right?
Right, literally. I mean, Boston burned to the ground because there was a fire started in Boston, and they couldn't get the horses to pull the fire engines, and Boston burned, you know? Everything rotted in the harbor in New York. I mean, you know, the great story is that the U.S. cavalry was reduced to fighting the Apaches on foot because there was no horses in Arizona. So you look at what happened in 1872, and then you look at our dependency today on highways and trucks and that sort of system, and you can see the parallels, and it's pretty frightening.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's frightening and amazing, really. That's like I said, when I finish reading the book, and already just from this brief conversation we've had so far, I mean, I'm learning so much. So kudos to you, Colin, because you know, you're bringing some serious knowledge to the listeners. Now, how did you end up sort of discovering the O'Reilly anomaly? Because, you know, you point out in the book that you really struggled with this as you first sort of came upon it and then decided, you know, to go all in on it because you just couldn't deny it anymore. So talk about, you know, that journey.
I think it's important to say, to explain to the listeners something, something fundamental, and that is that humans have known that horses can consume protein different types. I mean, when the book was released, there were originally 18 different types of meat, including human, that we knew horses had eaten. And this had occurred in 30 countries over a space of 4,000 years.
Yeah.
And I'm writing what's now, I call it the Horse Travel Handbook. It's actually bigger than that. It's the largest study of equestrian travel ever made, and it's going to allow people to read the book and then undertake a journey from Mongolia to Montana. It won't matter. You can go anywhere in the world with this book, and you can buy a horse and ride and explore. And when I came to the point where I had to write about, well, what do you feed the horse, I had to reference information that I had collected over, you know, decades. And I knew that people had fed horses meat. I had read this earlier when I first went to Afghanistan before the Soviets invaded in the late 70s. I had already read then that the Swedish explorer Sven Hedin had witnessed meat-eating horses in Tibet. And I recently was in contact with an editor, and I said, when I saw the words on the page, I could see the words, but I couldn't accept it. I mean, it just went into my brain, but it never really, I couldn't grasp it.
Yeah.
And the same thing happened in 1954 when National Geographic magazine reported that the entire Kazakh tribe fled the Chinese invasion, and they rode meat-eating horses out of China into India. And there the words were, right there on the page. It's November 1954, National Geographic, meat-eating horses, a tribe of people, etc. And you look at it and you go, yeah, right. And then you keep thinking, you just keep moving on. And so what happened was with this project is that when I went to sit down and say, okay, and I need to summarize this, I need to tell long riders that if you're someplace you can feed horses apricots, bananas, mangoes, grain, corn, sorghum. Oh, by the way, you can feed them meat. And I said, you know, I have some examples, but I just better take a look at this and see. Maybe I've overlooked something. And I'd say, Tim, I already had a lot of examples, most of them from Central Asia, from Tibet. And when I stopped, this was in January, so I'll just take a quick look, see if it's any, you know, see how much bigger it might be.
Right.
And I was really floored. I couldn't believe what was there right in front of me, in front of all of us. I mean, it's literally, you know, you see those trick pictures where you look at the picture and go, oh, you know, it's one kind of picture, and then you realize, oh, wait a minute, there's something else in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those kind of images, that's what it was with this. I mean, when you know what to look for, the evidence was just suddenly all in front of me, and that's what happened.
Interesting. Okay, so just amazing stuff. Let's talk about some of the evidence, because that's, you know, what is particularly interesting throughout the book. You know, I have just a boatload of notes here. So, you know, instead of asking you about all of the sort of ancient cases, you know, why don't you talk a little bit just sort of about how these things have shown up in the ancient times. You mentioned in the book King Diomedes and his savage equines, this whole story with Alexander the Great, the dappled demon of Japan. So this is something that not only spans thousands of years, as you say, but many countries as well, especially now looking here in the ancient stuff.
Well, you know, I think it's really interesting that you brought up Alexander the Great and the dappled demon, because most of us in the West, Western Europe and North America and Australia, we have been told this fairy tale that, well, little 12-year-old Alexander trained. I mean, he, you know, Bucephalus, his mighty war horse, was afraid of his shadow, and he moved the horse around, and he jumped on his back. And in fact, as the book explains, there was a much darker story. Bucephalus was a notorious man-killing, meat-eating horse, and the young prince, Alexander, went into this enclosure and got on that horse and rode him, thereby demonstrating his courage and his ability to overcome this dreadful monster. Now, that story was, like, pretty shocking, but within a couple of days, I discovered a mirror image of that story that happened 1,850 years later, 8,000 miles away in Japan. The Japanese have a story also about a young prince who encounters another vicious, meat-eating, man-killing horse, and he also rises to power by the same action. So what it demonstrates is that mankind has known about this, and that the evidence has been there, and it's only in the last 75 years that this has largely been suppressed.
Indeed, yeah. So, like, it was probably like common knowledge kind of back in the day, maybe back in, you know, I'm thinking about like the 1800s in America and stuff, that horses could eat meat. Well, I think it's interesting, too, that you point out in the book that you sort of make the distinction that we have two threads here that are running throughout the book, and they obviously cross at various times. But as you say in the book, it's the shocking true story of meat-eating and murderous horses. So we're talking about two separate sort of traits, if you will. There's the meat-eating right. part, and then there's also this idea, and you point out in the book numerous times, you know, that the common misconception amongst the mainstream is that the horse is an animal of prey, that it does not, you know, go out. It's not predatory. But as you say in the book, there's evidence that that's not the case at all. So we're talking about, like I said, meat-eating and murderous, a.k.a. predatory horses, like two separate traits that you've uncovered here. And as you say, they cross at various points, too.
Absolutely. I talk in the book about material that was supplied by Professor Richard Bullitt of Cornell, and how he talks about how horses operate in our world, how we view them today. And he has a theory called post-domesticity. And what it is that horses are now seen as almost fantasy figures. You know, they're gentle, they're quiet, they're angelic. You know, they're descended from Atlantis. These sort of things that, you know, they're just romantic figures. And we see them in a very idealized way. They, you know, horses have big eyes like babies. And people see them, and they gravitate to them, and they look beautiful. And what we don't appreciate, most of us in the modern world, because we don't live with horses on a daily basis like our predecessors did, is that horses can be incredibly dangerous. And the deciding factor with me about making this separate book, like I said, originally I was just going to mention meat-eating horses in terms of equestrian exploration. But I discovered that in the year 2007, a child had been killed in a really savage way in Australia. And I thought, you know, and I really grappled with this. I thought, you know, I don't need this. I don't want to do this. I just don't want the hassle of this. But I thought, well, you know, he was just an infant. I think he was 18 months old. And I thought, you know, maybe I ought to say something. You know, if there's an ethical situation here, maybe I ought to warn the public. And so I did that. That was the deciding factor in doing the book. But what's interesting, I think, is what happened after the book was released, because almost immediately there was five similar incidents where other people, including children, were also found to have been just absolutely savagely killed. And this gets back to the murderous part of horses. You know, they're very dangerous. They're not the benign, quiet little creatures that we like to think they are.
Yeah. Spooky stuff. Spooky. I've only been around a horse like twice, and they're kind of off-putting to me, so maybe I sensed it. I don't know. But I always think back to Christopher Reeve. If a horse can fell Superman, then...
Yeah. hangs her head and cries in my shirt. She must be hurt very badly. Tell me what's making you sadly. Open your door, don't hide in the dark. You're lost in the dark, you can trust me. 'Cause you know that's how it must be. Lisa, Lisa, sad Lisa, Lisa. Her eyes like windows trickle in rain upon her pain, getting deeper. Though my love wants to relieve her, she walks alone from wall to wall, lost in a hall. She can't hear me, though I know she likes to be near me. Lisa, Lisa, sad Lisa, Lisa. In a corner by the door, there must be more I can tell her if she really wants me to help her. I'll do what I can to show her the way, and maybe one day I will free her. Oh, I know no one can see her. Lisa, Lisa, sad Lisa, Lisa.
Hay luz de mediodía, si en una selva de armas juegan niños y en cada calle la ganó la vida. No estás en Asunción ni en Buenos Aires, no te has equivocado de aeropuerto, no se llama Santiago el fin de etapa. Su nombre es otro que Montevideo. La viste desde el aire, esta es Managua. De vientre ruinas, bella en sus baldíos. Pobre como la sal, combatientes.
sangre de sus hijos. Ya ves, viajero, está su puerta abierta. Todo el país es una inmensa casa. No te equivocaste de aeropuerto. Entra nomás, estás en Nicaragua.
Tiempo de libertad fue tu piloto. Brújula de pueblo te dio el norte. Cuántas manos tendidas esperándote. Cuántas mujeres, cuántos niños y hombres. Al fin labrando juntos el futuro. Al fin transfigurados en sí mismos. Mientras la larga noche de la infamia se pierde en él. Desprecio del olvido.
La viste desde el aire. Esta es Managua. De vientre ruinas, bella en sus baldíos. Pobre como las armas, combatiente. Como la sangre de sus hijos. Ya ves, viajero, está su puerta abierta. Todo el país es una inmensa casa. No te equivocas. Aeropuerto, entra nomás, estás en Nicaragua.
Is this thing on? Can you hear me now?
Een lang weekend of niet, we hebben geen tijd te verliezen dankzij een goed gevulde playlist. Goedenavond en welkom bij Signaruis. We starten met het knappe debuut van het Australische dameskwartet Body Type. Everything is dangerous, but nothing surprising is de welklinkende titel van het plaatje. En dit komt eruit The Brood van Body Type. We'll be right back. heerlijke energie op deze The Brood van Body Type, van op hun debuutalbum Everything is Dangerous But Nothing Surprising, opgenomen in amper 8 dagen tijd met Jonathan Boulay aan de knoppen. En nu we het toch over deze man hebben, Jonathan Boulay is ook de drummende helft van Party Dozen, een muzikaal samenwerkingsverband met saxofoniste Kirsty Tickle. In juli mogen we hun nieuwe plaat The Real Work verwachten. Voor op die plaat hebben ze voor het eerst ook een gastmuzikant en niet de minste. Nick Cave laat zijn demonen nog eens los. Dit is Party Dozen en Nick Cave met Mecca the Mud.